We'd buy a pack of Old North State smoking tobacco. It cost a nickel. See, they had paper. They had papers. Listen, they didn't have any paper, but we'd get papers of theirs. And we liked this right here because we put it in our shirt pocket. And that little tag would hang up. It looked kind of macho for us. And then behind Irwin, we had a YMCA there at Irwin. Still got it. Real good YMCA. And we'd go down. There's a big cover down there. Big enough that you could walk into. It's right behind the YMCA. We'd walk in there and we'd smoke. We'd smoke with those hobos. We'd smoke tobacco. And then that this cost a nickel. That leave us 20 cents. Then we would take a dime each and give to that woman, and she'd give us a ticket, and we'd go on into the movie. See the movie. We were under 12 years old. Well, we got older. As we got older, we got too big to get in for a dime. So they were charging us a quarter. Well, they never did charge us because we never did pay that. So what we'd do, we'd take that 20 cents, and when she wasn't looking, we'd run around the corner there and dash through the door and give that 20 cents to Sidney Googe. He was taking the tickets there, Sidney Googe. He lived in Irwin there. Mm-hmm. Married Betty Jo Googe. She lives in Irwin. Mm-hmm. Her name was a Clayton. I used to know her in high school. Yeah. Her name was Betty Jo Clayton. Well, we'd give that 20 cents to Sidney. That tickled him. He'd most of us going in. We'd go and see the movie, and the movie would last about 4 hours because it'd have a serial and a news and the previews, and then that serial would always keep us kind of nervous because it'd show the Lone Ranger or somebody, and they'd be riding along, and they'd look like they were falling off of a cliff, and then it would quit. We'd say continue until next week. Then we'd worry all week about whether the Lone Ranger got killed or not, and then the next week we'd go and just as he leaped over there, he grabbed a limb, or whoever was on the horse grabbed a limb, and he swung down on the ground that way and saved himself, and we were all relieved that he didn't get killed. Mm-hmm. And then Buster Crabb was, sometimes they had cereals. Buster Crabb was Tarzan back then. And then at the end of the theater, end of that cereal, these were cereals, in that cereal, an alligator was coming straight toward him, with his big mouth, right at Buster Crabb, and we said, he'll never make it. And Buster Crabb pulled out a big old stick about that long, stuck it in that alligator's mouth, and that alligator couldn't bite him. So that kept us, that kind of settled our nerves a little bit, thinking that he's going to live.
Yeah. Oh, those sound better than the ones that are playing today, for sure.
Yeah, and then the Three Stooges were very common back then, and they hired in at a golf club. There was a root sticking out of the ground. And they said, we want you to get rid of that root and pull that root up. And so they said, all right, and Larry and Curly and Moe. And they began pulling on that root. And then at the end of the show, it showed them. And they had pulled that root for about a mile, and they tore up a whole golf course. So anyway, that was the way we, and some of the people would bring, see, it lasts about from 9 o'clock, I guess, until about 12 or 12:30 or 1 o'clock, 40. So someone would bring their lunch with them. Mm-hmm. We didn't bring our lunch because we probably didn't have any.
So the movie started in the morning? You could watch movies in the
morning?
Yeah,
we could go early in the morning now. Okay. And stay till about dinner time. And like I say, we'd see some of them carrying lunch in there, and they didn't. They said that was all right, I guess.
were movies only played on the weekends, like on a Saturday? Or?
It's Saturday, yeah. Saturday. That was the big day. Mm. And like I say, the movies and everything lasted from about 9 o'clock until about 12:30, 1 o'clock. Someone would watch it over and over, like Gone with the Wind would come, they'd watch it double.
Did you see Gone with the Wind?
Yeah, in 1938.
Wow.
And then I saw it again the other night, sometime back about a month ago, I saw it here on television. And I like to watch it because it's interesting. It was about the history of this country, you know, and very interesting, you know. So that's where it was.
Which high school did you go to?
Which one?
Which high school did you go to?
Irwin.
Irwin High School. And did you have a job while in school, or did you work while in high school?
Yeah, I worked at a drugstore after school, mm-hmm. quite a bit. Quite a while, or maybe a year or so. Mm-hmm. But I went in. See, we agreed to go to the draft, and I went in when I was 16. I went down and signed up for the draft, and they took me within 4 or 5 days. And these guys never did show up, and I just went on. Like I said, I went to Fort Oglethorpe, and there they transferred me into the Marines. I went to Parris Island. Then the first thing they did was you had 17 weeks of intense training, mm-hmm. hard training, which is good because you read about these guys that get trans, whatever they call it, that's some kind of something, and they don't know where they're at or what they're doing or something. And I think if you have real hard training for 17 weeks, you're not subject to break under bad conditions. You kind of, mm-hmm. you have to be kind of tough. Yeah.
How long were you at Parris Island?
I was there probably about 18 or 19, maybe 18 weeks, I guess.
And you served in the Marines?
Right.
Can you identify the regiment and division that you were in?
Have what?
Can you identify the regiment and the division of the Marines that you were served in?
Well, after I left there, I went to Camp Lejeune, mm-hmm. Lejeune, in Wilmington, North Carolina, and took amphibious training. And one guy drowned up there, he couldn't swim. By the way, I'll tell you another funny story. If you couldn't, you had to swim or you couldn't graduate. You had to pass the swim test. And the people that couldn't swim, they called it the submarine patrol. And there'd be about five or six out of each platoon that couldn't swim. And they'd get them all together on certain nights. And they'd come right down Main Street where everybody was gathered. They'd come down Main Street. They'd give out an order. I don't remember what the order was, but they had all they were wearing was little old purple, woolly looking swim trunks and brogans. They were marching them down through there. Mm-hmm. And like I say, they called them the submarine patrol. And they'd give out an order that said, submarine patrol. And they'd yell out this order, I don't remember what it was, but they'd all drop down and start duck wobbling and quacking like ducks as they went down the street. And everybody would kind of laugh about that. if you stenciled, one guy stenciled his belt, it's supposed to turn the name inside your belt, and he had it on the outside. And they made him put it, he folded up and put it in his mouth. They made him carry it around 2 or 3 days in his mouth. And that was one of the ways. And if you got too much mail, they'd make you read some of it. And some of them throw it up on the roof of the building. You couldn't hardly get it. And I didn't want them to send me any mail. I didn't want to get caught in anything. But one time I got a couple letters. They called my name and you said, yes, sir. And then you run down through there real fast and you had to go fast and pick it up. And I didn't, it was dark. They'd drag you out of there about 5:30 in the morning. Because they said that's when the mosquitoes had to eat, and so they like to eat on us. Well, anyway, I went running down through there, and I stepped in a mud puddle. I didn't see it. It was dark, and it splattered mud on the drill instructor. He said, you're going to have to ride the range now. And we didn't know what he was talking about. None of us did. I said, well, the only range around here is the rifle range. And I said, if we ride the range, we won't be out there riding around where the bullets are at. We'll be riding around in a Jeep, probably. And I said, that won't be bad. I don't care about that. Well, I was wrong. Friday came up, and he said, no, it was Monday came up. He said, okay, tonight's your night. You got to go up and ride the range this week. And I went up there and riding the range. They had a a stove or a range about wider than that table, about 1.5 times that long, about 6 foot wide, about 8 foot long, I guess. And I got up on there and put sacks under my knees to keep burning, because it's still hot. Mm-hmm. And put sacks on my hands and steel wool under that, that's how I rode the range. I cleaned the range. Range. So
that was not riding in the Jeep.
No, it was kind of different. We didn't have anything good. Mm-hmm. And if you got anything, like we had one guy, he got some cookies from home, and that was when they got had letter. They said, "Are you telling your people that we're not feeding you enough?" And he said, "No, sir." And they said, "You come on back here." And the drill instructors were in one end of the barracks, and they had a set of weights in there. And they said, "While you're lifting these weights, we're going to eat these cookies." And they ate those cookies, then made him eat the paper.
Oh, that's tough. They did so many mean things.
I don't think he didn't tell his parents. He said, "Don't send me any more cookies." And then if you got 4 or 5 letters, you had to take your shirt off and run to a belt line. Everybody's mad anyway, and they just warped. They wanted to hit somebody, take out some revenge on somebody. They'd warp and they'd run through that belt line. And so it was always something like that. And I've got some other funny stories. Like, we had one guy, he was from Crab Orchard, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And J.D. Thompson, he worked for the railroad over there, laying cross ties before he came in the Marines. He was about 5'10" and real strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had a guy come in that was his same size. They wore the same size clothes. But J.D. was solid as rock. And this guy was a boxer. And boy, he was good too. And anybody mess up, they had to box him. And this lasted about 1.5 minutes. And he'd hit him in the ribs. They'd just fall down on the ground half dead. And they went up to him and they said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Private Marvin Tink." No, he said, "Marvin Tinker, sir." And he was from Connecticut. They said, "What's your name?" He said, "Marvin Tinker, sir." And they got right in his face and you could see saliva flying in his face. And he said, "What in the hell were you, colonel, general, major? What are you?" Mm-hmm. He said, "Private Marvin Tinker, sir." That's the way, you don't have to write all that in there if you want to. But anyway, we had all kinds of things do like that. And one guy, they give physical exercise, and one guy said, "Sir, I feel faint." And this guy said, "I don't give a damn, go ahead and faint." And that guy just fell over on the ground. They didn't pay attention to him. They just kept doing their exercise and stuff like that. Sometimes we'd have to take shots and say, sometimes two at a time. Sometimes one or two of them fainted on that. They were shots against malaria and stuff like that, I think. I don't know. It's kind of heavy shots. But anyway, that was what was it. And then some of these guys we had a guy, well, I'll tell you about J.D., a little bit more about him since you're on it. He was back in a little cave, just a tiny place, and two Marines were out here in the foxhole, and they were supposed to guard. They were guarding everything, watching for Japs and all. And the Japs somehow got in there. Japs are good fighters. And they killed both those Marines. And when J.D. woke up, he was being bayoneted in the eye, nose, throat, and several times around the heart. And before we could get him to the hospital ship, he had to go down through there. And it's dangerous to go, because Jeff be shooting at you. We finally got him down to the beach, and then we got him on a boat and took him out to the hospital ship. And this Jeff, before poor J.D. kept a K-bar knife here in the ground, and he had that knife to kill that Jap, but before he did, the Jap bit him in the back of the leg, and it set up gangrene, and they wanted to take his leg off. But he wouldn't let them take it off. And after the war, they told him he could be on his feet 6 hours a day. And so he went to school on the G.I. Bill and bought a tractor and decided he's going to raise cattle. Mm-hmm. And he bought a herd of cattle in a pasture out there, bought it. And then about that time, this is 1946, the interstate came between his house and the cattle. And he had to drop that cattle business. And then later he gave the land to Crossville, and they made an elementary school out of it. If you ever go by, not Frog Pond, but what's that little old place just for, where J.D. lived, where they mine, what's that rock they call it? I'll think of it a day or two. I can't think of nothing. It's nearly on my mind. it's some kind of rock there that they mine. It's really real nice rock.
Is it a quarry, like a limestone quarry?
Yeah, they quarry rock. I nearly had it on my mind. It's some kind of stone.
Stone.
Not flagstone, but something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, he lives about one third of a mile, or he did now, past, no, if you go past that rock quarry, flagstone, not flagstone, but something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You go one third of a mile past it, you'll see a nice big elementary school out there, and he gave them that land. That's where his cattle were. And when he was sick and in bed and didn't have long to live, I went over to see him, and he had a great big old thing up there given to a great citizen of Crossville, because he had given that land over there to build that school on. Mm-hmm. Had easy access in and out to it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I can't think of that rock.
So yeah,
Crab Orchard stone.
Crab Orchard.
it's very nice stone that they use it a lot. They mine it and everything. And that's a chief industry in Crab Orchard. That's about all there is there.
Did you rescue J.D.
Did
Thompson?
I rescue him?
Did you pull him like from safety, or did you how in the battle, because you were Iwo Jima with J.D. Thompson?
Now the guy that I mentioned a while ago, Tinker, the boxer,
mm-hmm.
They were both the same size. They could change clothes, same thing. He was about 185 or 90 pounds. His stomach looked like a brick wall. Anyway, they gave him a flamethrower to carry, because flamethrowers weigh 70 pounds. And I didn't see him, but J.D. did. J.D. Thompson, he was alive. That was before he got killed. Got hurt real bad. He saw him, or maybe it was after that. He saw a bullet go in one of the tanks. There's two tanks on a flamethrower, and one of them went in. And I don't know which one it was, but it burned him so fiercely that he couldn't get out of it. He burned up before he could get unharnessed from that. I don't mean to tell you all these bad things, but that's kind of the way it was all the time.
Tell her about when you were carrying that guy out that was hurt. He was like the...
I had a buddy. He was a real good friend of mine. He was
the
from Binghamton, New York. And his name was Donald Goodman, and he had won 16 letters in high school, good athlete.
Mm-hmm.
We wrestled around a little bit to kind of stay in shape, too. We were good buddies, though, real good buddies. Well, every now and then we had to have water, and ammunition and some kind of rations, and we had to go get them. And whoever drew the low card, we'd cut cards, whoever get the low card had to go. Mm-hmm. And I would always get that low card, and he would too. And we went down there, and it's dangerous to go because Japs would shoot you. And on the way back, he got shot right in the shoulder. Mm-hmm. Had made a hole in his shoulder that big. I thought the bullet was still down in his body. But the next day I found out, or I wouldn't have done some things I did. I dragged him along ground. But he had a hole as big as a pipe hand, and about that deep down in his lower body next to his, right above his right buttocks. And they were throwing grenades at us, and it was dark. And we were on a solid rock, and there was a solid rock wall about that big, and then a huge rock wall, and the Japs were up on there, and they were throwing grenades at us. And when they'd throw a grenade at you, the way the grenade, they were concussion grenades. They weren't, we had grenades that had cast iron squares in, and the iron would kill you. But these were concussion grenades, and they would send you up in the air. You'd go up in the air, you'd be suspended in the air for several seconds. I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 seconds, because I'd feel myself. I'd say, am I wounded? And I said, no, I'm not wounded. And he wasn't either. But the grenades were that close to us, and they kept throwing them, and they were up on there, and we couldn't see them to do anything. And so I got him by the back of the collar, and I dragged him about the length of a football field and a half. That'd be 150 yards. And finally I spotted some guys, and they came and helped me. They had a stretcher. They came and got him on the stretcher. And they took him in and laid him down, and then to these medics, they turned him over, and that's when I saw that huge thing out there. Well, by that time the Seabees had built an airstrip in there, and there's a plane came from Hawaii every day to get wounded. So they got him and took him to Pearl Harbor. And then he wrote a letter from Pearl Harbor, and he mentioned my name that I had helped him in. And his son came down to see me. His son, I forget his son's name, but anyway, he came down to see me, and we had a pretty good visit. But anyway, Donald got back to the hospital, and I guess he was able to do something, but he was some kind of a teacher, because they said he was voted the man of the year in Bingham, New York. And then he wrote in a paper, he wrote in a letter. They found the letter he wrote, and said that he got hit, and that I crawled up to him and said I'd help him, which I did. I crawled up there, because I was afraid to get above that ledge. I was afraid they'd see me, shoot me. And I crawled up there, and so I got him, and I dragged him. And if I'd known that he'd had that huge wound down there in his back, I might not have dragged him, but I had to get him out of there or stay there and get killed. And we had to get out of there, so I didn't have time to make any decisions. I just had to get out of there. And I dragged her down, and I finally located some stretcher bearers. They were carrying a stretcher. They were carrying a dead man on it. And I motioned them, they laid that dead man off and rushed down there and got him on it, took him down to the medic. And the guy that's dead, what didn't make it. Oh, and I'll tell you one more thing that's kind of strange. I never was a good gambler. I knew I wasn't. But I knew a guy that was a good gambler. And we got paid. and we just got $50 a month. They'd take out $5 for insurance and $5 for a Leatherneck magazine, which wasn't much of a magazine. But anyway, we got $40 a month. So I took that $40, and like I say, I wasn't a good gambler, and I knew I wasn't. But I bet on this guy that was a good gambler, and I won $200. And that was quite a bit of money, you know, for people making $40 a month. Mm-hmm. And so after, on the way to Iwo Jima, this guy asked me if he could borrow $50. I didn't know what he was going to do on Iwo Jima, but I thought he might have thought I was going to get killed, and which I nearly did. And then he would say, well, he can't use it anymore, something like that. So, but anyway, when I turned loose at Donald Lockhart on that stretcher and gave it to these other stretcher guys, that guy that had borrowed $50 from me, he was carrying a windy guy on a stretcher. And he was all bent over, like he was a big tall guy, he was about 6'5". He's big tall, gangly, and it's hard to carry. You know, you get a Marine on there and he's got a lot of equipment, gun, rifles, and this, that, and other. You're carrying about 60, each person's carrying about 60 pounds, or 65 or 70 pounds. Time you got all that ammunition, grenades, and water, and pack on your back there. And so he was real weary carrying that stretcher. And I said, his name was Paul. And I said, Paul, I had a rifle. I was out front then. I had a rifle. And I said, you take my rifle. Yeah.
You were scouting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I said, you take my rifle, and I'll carry this stretcher, because he was real tired from carrying it. He carried that rifle, went down there right about where I'd been, but then he rounded the corner there. I hadn't gone around there. He rounded the corner. When he got around there, he got shot about 60 times in the head. His cell helmet flew off, and that little fiberglass helmet underneath him rattled up and down. And he walked right into a machine gun nest. There's a little bit of dried grass there, and you couldn't tell if anything is on the side of the hill. Looked like a, and they had a machine gun there, and they shot him, just went round and round his head, probably 50, 60 times. And
if so he hadn't helped carry that guy, it would have been him. He was scouting up ahead. Yeah. I said, if you hadn't helped out with that guy, it would have been you.
Yeah, if I hadn't gone up there and done that, it might have been me. I don't.
Yeah, because you might have gone around there too.
But then after, I think that we finally knocked that pillbox out. Then we got in there to get Paul, mm-hmm. and put him on a stretcher and carry him down there. And we laid him down there, mm-hmm. where we were safe. I mean, it's kind of secure down there. And one of them guys laying there said, he borrowed $50 from you, didn't he? I said, yes, he did. And he said, did like that, like while he's laying there, just go ahead and get it. But I thought, no, I'm single and don't really need the money that bad. And his wife will get $10,000, but I'd rather she'd also have that $50.
Yeah.
But later, I went to work. I'm going too fast for you.
You're good. You're good.
Well, I knew he, by the way, his wife had sent him a letter, in it she sent little squares of cloth and she was making with their daughter. And he had an envelope. When he fell over, that envelope fell out of his jacket. Those little squares were blowing around. Then I knew that he lived in Hampton Roads, Virginia. I got a job up at Hampton Roads on a refinery. we enjoyed it up there too, because it had a big backyard. And my older son, who's 63 now, he was about six then, and he got him a little sailor cap, and the Chesapeake Bay came right in behind our house. He'd walk out there and the sailors would wave at him, and they'd say, "Hey, sailor." He'd wave at him, he'd stand out there and wave at him. And it was a nice to live there. We had a pretty good time. Had a nice apartment there. So then it was good fishing there and all that sort of stuff. So we lived there about 2 years, I guess.
Was this just right after? When was this? Or when did you live there?
What did I do?
Or when did you live there?
I'm not sure of the dates, but I can about figure that. About 51, I guess.
So this is after the war?
About 51, 52, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I found interesting, and he doesn't like to tell it, was when you were in that cave. Y'all, they went in a cave, and the Japs were all shooting, and when you came out, what you heard, he doesn't like to tell that.
Those words I heard?
Yes.
Well, I don't know whether people believe it or not, but I'll tell it anyway. There's been a pretty good-sized cave there, and the Navy was out there shooting, and Japs were probably around there at that time, and they kept shooting, and they kept shooting, and they made a cavern in there. It's as big as this room, maybe a little longer, and it's about this high, and it's just rock all the way around, and they said, "We got to leave. We got to pull out of here." And I was the last one to leave. And like I said, I kind of hesitate telling people this. They think I'm lying, but I'm not. I'm not trying to show off or do anything like that. I don't care about it. But when I left, I was leaving. I was the last one to leave. And as I was leaving, it's like somebody talking, and the words are reverberating off that wall up there, and I don't remember the exact words, but it's something to the effect that said, "You're going to live through this," or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And you said how many men got killed in that, right then, in that area where you were, and there was only, what, about 40-something survived out of how many?
You mean how many died altogether?
Yeah, right there on that, where you, right then, right there where you were. On Okinawa, Iwo Jima.
How many men were killed?
In your unit.
Oh, in my unit, we landed there with 35 men, and when we left, there was five of us, and one of them, I don't know where he came from, we didn't even know him, but he just joined in with us. I guess he didn't have, I don't know, maybe he didn't have any other place to go. He just joined in with us. And,
so, I mean, that's why I find it interesting off the wall that he survived and he so nearly died.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had 8,600 Marines killed there. 8,600. That's a lot of Marines to look around to see them laid everywhere. And we had to carry them. We carried them over there on a stretcher. We carried one Marine at a time. That's all he could carry. Mm-hmm. Carried on a stretcher. And they had a bulldozer and they'd pile of dirt about as high as this thing right here, a little bit longer, and they'd stick a new shovel in it. And our job was to lay them down, face up, take that shovel and cover them with dirt till they had time to dig graves for them. And then they had a cemetery there for dogs, or they had about a dozen dogs killed. And they had Rex and Rusty and blah, 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 blah.
They had a dog with them.
Little.
Oh,
yeah, I had a dog.
Is it?
I don't like to think about it. That's the dumbest dog ever was. I will mention, we had that dog, and the reason I ended up with him, had a guy named Joe somebody. I didn't know his last name. I can't think of it now, but we called him one time. Gary did, and he had died just a little bit before that, but his son was there, but his daughter-in-law answered the phone, Joe something other, I can't think. Well, anyway, Joe, I watched that dog, and Joe would raise his arm, and that dog would leap up. Mm-hmm. He'd drop his arm real quick, that dog would lay down. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, if I got with Joe, I wouldn't even have standing guard duty, probably. That dog would guard for us. That is a big, big, dumb thing to think. Well, anyway, but Joe got caught in the mortar barrage that before it got dark that night. He got caught in the mortar barrage, and it was kind of addled, and they took him off somewhere. And that dog was out there just like the Lone Ranger. And so along about 8:30 or so, well, when it got dark, since it got dark, we heard somebody snoring real loud. And I mean, it reverberated all over for an acre out there, yeah. I guess. And we had tin cans tied in our foxhole and a wire running to the other foxhole, and they had the same thing. And I hollered over and said, "Who's that snoring over there? Who's that making that loud snoring?" They said, "It's not us." And they come on. Yeah. Then I had to look way out there, about pretty far out there, about 60 feet, I'd say. That dog was laying out there, and he was snoring. Oh. And I picked up a rock and threw at him. And I don't know whether it hit him or not, but he woke up and moved in closer. But it didn't snore so much that way, because if it did, we'd have killed him.
Right. Yeah.
And so then the next day, they put me with that dog. And I didn't like that, because I was like a Lone Ranger out there with that dog. And these other guys, they were hiding behind rocks with a rifle. And I had that old dog, and I didn't have any protection at all. And we'd go somewhere, and then I also worried about him. We had a lieutenant step on a landmine. They had landmines, and they'd put them around grass. And a lieutenant stepped on it, blew both of his legs off. That's how powerful they were. Well, that dog, he was weighed about 140 pounds. He was some kind of big old Rottweiler or something like that. And if he'd have stepped on one, it'd probably blown him halfway up in there. But anyway, I was afraid to get near him. I was afraid he was going to step on one, because we'd go around to all these places. And anyway, we finally got out of there. And then that dog, this doesn't sound real nice and pleasant, but if you want to write about it, you can. If you don't, well, it don't matter. We'd eat maybe one can of sea rations, and that'd be about all we'd eat, because they were awful. And he'd go up down 6 or 7 cans, just licking it up, and he'd lick the rock and lick it and carry on. And then, as a result, he had diarrhea real bad. And he'd have to stop real regular. They'd say, "What in the hell's going on up there?" They'd holler. And I'd say, "The dog's got diarrhea." And they'd say, "Well, shoot him." And I wanted to. In fact, I'd try to force him in one of those caves, hoping a Jap would kill him. And he'd come rushing out there mad at me, growling at me. And I was afraid to fool with him much after that, because he got kind of mean with me. Well, anyway, we had to go all the way to the north end of Iwo Jima. And we did, and I thought we never would get there. And I was scared every step of the way. Because I didn't have any protection. They were hiding behind rocks. They'd run from one rock to another, and run to another rock and hide. There I was out there like a Lone Ranger. Nothing, no way, no protection. Well, we finally did make it up to the tip end, all the way to the very tip end of Iwo Jima, the north end. And I looked down there, and there's Japs laying down there. It's hot under those volcanic islands. And they come out, and they were laying in water about that deep to cool them off. And I pointed down that way, and then I got that dog back. I was afraid he'd bark. And I pulled him down a ravine down through there. I just dragged him up there nearly. And we got down there, and I got up out of the way where I could see what was going on, and also make sure if any Japs come running down through there, I could shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, I heard lots of shooting up there. And there's 10 Japs down there, and these guys in the platoon shot them. They were all laying down there in the water sleeping. And one of them swam through the water and nearly got away, and they said they finally shot him too.
Yeah.
So he killed all of them. Mm-hmm. And about 2 months later, we got back to Guam. About 2 months later, 2.5, I don't know. Anyway, we got back to Guam and we got a leather neck. And it was, and it showed this dog on a cover and said he had tracked these Japs down. That made real good reading, you know. Mm-hmm. He tracked them down and pointed and motioned and let us know that he'd found them. And they shot all these Japs, they killed them all. And they said that dog had tracked them down and they killed them. That makes real good, interesting reading. And I had a picture of that dog on the front page of the letter. And that was exciting to read, but it was untrue. But as long as people like to read it, well, they wouldn't want to put it out there, you know. But he was, and once he run down and licked a Jap in the face. We were walking down through there, and I had a sack of grenades on my shoulder, and had a rifle, and a pack on my back, and I don't know what else. And I couldn't get to my rifle, but there's a guy named Ryback. He had a rifle, and he shot it. But before he shot this Jap, this dog ran over and licked that Jap in the face. he was really mean. I'm glad he didn't see any other Japs walking up through there, because he had run and licked him in the face. But Ryback shot him, blew his whole jaw off. Shot him about 3 or 4 times with an M1. It blew his whole jaw off. Because Ryback had met him and he said, "One for my buddy." His buddy got killed. And he said, "One for my buddy." So that's where it was. And then I got a lot of other stuff I could tell, but I guess that's all that kind of stuff you need to know about.
did that dog have a name? Did you name that dog?
That dog?
Yeah, did he have a name that you guys...
I can't remember his name now.
He has got the best memory that I've ever... It's amazing when he tells stories that he remembers people's names and
yes,
everything about them, where they were from. And
I can't think of that
dog's
name.
It's just amazing to me.
It is.
But I asked Joe, his handler. I said, "Do you handle a lot of dogs when you were a civilian?" He said, "No, I never did food with them."
Yeah, I can't remember you ever telling me that dog's name.
I'll think of one of them. But we call him so many bad names. I can't remember his good name, regular name.
One thing that, and I don't want to talk because you're recording, is that he has a movie on Iwo Jima.
Yeah, they carry little dog tags.
Yeah.
And they had a cemetery there for him, and where their cross is at, they had little crosses about like that, and they had a little dog tag there. They'd say Rex and Rusty and blah, blah, blah. They had 15 or 20 dogs killed.
Yeah. What I was thinking is maybe you could get a copy of that movie. His son could have a copy of it made. That movie we watched the other day about Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
Do you think that Gary could get a copy of that and send it to her, get a copy of it made?
Well, it wouldn't show me in there, nothing like that.
Okay, yeah.
I could ask about it later. Thank you for mentioning that. After you were at Iwo Jima, then you went to Guam?
Went back to Guam.
Guam, and then?
Then sometime after that, not too many months, maybe 3 months, the war was over. Mm-hmm. Now, when I first went to Guam, I first went there, we were following, we were just back in the pack. We just got off a ship and back in the pack, and we were going up there. I spent 17 months, I don't remember, it seemed like it's somehow, I forget how many weeks, months I spent there. But anyway, we got there and we were just following these people, and we had scouts up ahead, and we heard shooting up ahead. There's a lot of Japs still on the island. And they were mean to the Guamanian people too. Anyway, we heard shooting up there, and they were way ahead of us, about a quarter of a mile ahead of us. We finally got up there where they were at, and these Marines were eating potatoes. They were eating fried potatoes. They run upon these Japs, and these Japs were frying potatoes, and they killed them, and they were laying around them there where they shot them. And so these Marines, then these Marine scouts were eating these potatoes, and that's the way. And then about the time the war was ended, and they knew it, the Japs came out. They called us up there one time, all of us up there, the whole battalion. We went up there, and the Japs were lined up, and they were lined up in a row, and they were surrendering because they'd heard the atomic bomb was there, and they knew the war was about over. Because and then later we went to Japan and went right through Nagasaki about 3 weeks after they dropped a bomb there. And I guess we got a lot of radiation there because they probably didn't know anything about radiation. And we went through there, and it was pretty well level. And we went down to Miyazaki, Japan. Miyazaki. And the war was over. Just about over. They knew it was going to be over in just a few days. But when we got down there, we had Japanese barbers, and they would shave you and give you a haircut. Shave you for a quarter, give you a haircut for a quarter. But when they get around my throat there, I hope it won't take no slice my jugular thing. But anyway, then we'd go out there and dump our rash kits in these galvanized cans, and then the women, some come out there, some of them have babies, and they would catch that food, and I felt sorry for them because you know the women didn't have anything to do with the war, and they had babies, and so I'd take milk, and act like I'd open it, but I'd leave it full of milk, And then I'd lay soap there too, and then I'd lay bread there too, some bread.
Yeah.
Just anything to eat to survive.
It was so sad they had so many babies and orphanages there.
Yeah, and they had little babies and all. And I'd watch the Japanese women. They put me on guard at a schoolhouse up there. Mm-hmm. And these Japanese women were real good with children, and these children were well mannered. The teacher, she'd motion them to do something, they'd run and do it. And I felt sorry for the women.
Was there any tension, because this is just the war has just ended and you're in Japan right now with helping out at the schoolhouse. Like, was there any tension with it, just because of your being American?
Yeah. Oh, well, we were there for maybe a couple of months, I forget what kind of troops they call it, but anyway, we were there to make sure to keep everything under control, and they stayed under control. Because
he said they loved the Americans.
Yeah, oh. And so
that's weird.
So we let me get a sip of water.
Oh, sure.
Here.
Take a break.
You get you a sip too while you're resting.